time together today, and we're finishing the book of Proverbs of Solomon, chapters 30 and 31. We've been going rather rapidly through these Proverbs. They're worth pondering and thinking about one at a time. As far as anybody knows, these Proverbs originated with Solomon, the king of Israel, the wisest man in the ancient world. And we come to chapters 30, 31 today, which were added later by a guy named Agur, and the son of Jacob, and there's two other men here, Ithiel and Ukal, who evidently collected these proverbs and tacked them on at the end. Surely I am more stupid than any man, and do not have the understanding of a man. I neither learned wisdom nor have knowledge of the Holy One, says the writer. The writer here is a humble man that probably could be Solomon, and he says that he doesn't know very much about God or the wisdom of God, and his knowledge of the Holy One is limited. Well, that's a good place to be. He says, who has ascended into heaven or descended? Who has gathered the wind in his fist? Who has bound the waters in a garment? Who has established all the ends of the earth? What is his name, and what is his son's name, if you know? That sounds like the New Testament in a way. What's the name of God, and what's the name of his son? The name of his son is Jesus, of course. So this is 3,000 years ago when this was written. It sounds like the book of Job, when God called Job into account, pulled him up short and said, hey, were you there when I created the universe? Tell me all about all these things. And of course, Job has to admit he knows nothing. He wasn't there when God created the universe. This is a very beautiful. Verse 4 is a very beautiful. Now in verse 5, every word of God is pure. He is a shield to those who put their trust in him. Do not add to his words, lest he reprove you and you be found a liar. That's pretty heavy duty. We ought not to tamper with God's word, to either add to it or take away from it or to paraphrase it carelessly. God protects the integrity of his word. Translators are very, very careful to take the Hebrew and the Greek and render them into good English. It just goes on in every generation. The Bibles we have now are very trustworthy and have been studied in great detail. Alternate versions have been considered and prayed over and so on. So we have very good English Bibles. Scholars that are finicky will read the Hebrew and the Greek to get the nuances out of the text. Every word of God is pure. He is a shield to those who put their trust in him. Do not add to his words, lest he reprove you and you be found a liar. It's nice to know that we have absolute truth available for us in the Bible and in Jesus in a world of relative knowledge of disappearing truth, of people being ignorant of God. We have an absolute reference in the heavens. And the reference is in Jesus, but it's also in the Word of God. Two things I request of you. Deprive me not before I die. Hey, old man here. Remove falsehood and lies far from me. Oh, God, that I should lie and mislead people and turn them astray by being careless in handling the scriptures. Feed me with the food you, God, prescribe for me. In other words, teach me, Lord, and guide me every day, lest I be full and deny you. Lest I be satiated, lest I be self-satisfied, lest I be content with essentially a compromised position in the world. So he wants to not be poor, and he wants to not misrepresent God. So that's a big statement about wisdom. Do not malign a servant to his master, lest he curse you and you be found guilty. This is a proverb, we're back to the Proverbs again, where it's not a good idea for us to badmouth an employee in the presence of his employer. That gets you in trouble with both the employee and the employer, because they have a working relationship and mutual trust, and you want to come in and violate that, that's uncool. Verse 11. In verse 11, we get four different kinds of examples of what to do or not to do. There is a generation that curses its father, does not bless its mother. So he says, we see in everyday life men and women who curse their parents and belittle their parents. This is a self-made man who worships his own creator, and he does not have anything good to say about his mom and his dad, who poured themselves into him for good or for bad. So, not a good idea. There is a
and it's also honor your father and mother and the Ten Commandments.
Absolutely,
and
yeah.
That has already come past. I mean, it's been in the past. So they have that, right? They have the law.
That's right.
Up to this point.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
There is a generation that's pure in its own eyes, yet it is not washed from its filthiness. That's almost humorous, because we get people growing up that think, I'm basically good, I'm a moral person, I'm doing fine, my generation's doing fine, we've got a few little issues to work out. And that's a denial of what God says about us, that we all have no inherent worth, that we're all lost and deceived. But every generation seems to think that they've arrived and they know more than their parents do, and so on. There is a generation. Oh, how lofty are their eyes, and their eyelids are lifted up. There is a generation whose teeth are like swords, whose fangs are like knives, to devour the poor from the earth and the needy from among men. So he's looking at society, the ruthlessness, the backstabbing, the betrayal that goes on underneath the face of people that look good on the surface and pretend to be good, but they're backstabbers, they're backbiters, they're vicious. And God knows the hearts, and we don't always know the hearts of another person. So he's talking about a generation growing up around him, wise in their own eyes, arrogant, opinionated, vicious and cruel. Okay, so we now come to some proverbs that are numbered in the Hebrew Bible. The first is, the leech has two daughters. Give, give, they say. A leech, I don't know if you've ever seen a blood leech. They're a worm-like object. In the old days, when the king would get sick, they'd have a whole bunch of leeches, put them on his body, and he would become anemic from loss of blood, and they thought they were getting all the poison out of his system with these leeches. Leeches are still used in medical treatment when you've got a boil or a blood blister that needs to be drained. You just put leeches on it, and the leeches clean up a wound. The leech has two daughters. I mean, now, we use the word leech today in the sense of speaking about people who use other people, who cheat them. We say so-and-so is a leech. That means they'll come after you for money and never pay you back. They always want you to do favors, but they never return the favors. So that's there are three things that are never satisfied, four things that never say it is enough. So he's going to list four things that he sees in life that are pretty common that never quit. And they are the grave, the barren womb, the earth that is not satisfied with water, the fire that never says it is enough. Well, the grave is inevitable, where you die and your body goes in the ground and dies and decays and returns to the elements. And cemeteries and graveyards are everywhere. And nobody has found out how to reverse this inexorable process of aging and dying. So that's an enigma. We do not have, by our own natural reason, an answer to the problem of death. The other thing that's grievous in life is a woman who wants to get pregnant and can't, who's a barren woman. She longs to bring a child into the world. She may not even have, there may not even be an heir to the family name and fortune, and because she's barren. Oftentimes a king or somebody in place would get a second wife. I think of Hannah in the book of 1 Samuel, who was barren, and her husband had another wife who had a lot of kids, and Hannah begged for a son, and God gave her the son Samuel, who became the first of the prophets, first of the last of the prophets, first of the kings. Not kings. Well, anyway.
Judges. Yeah, he was the judges, last of the judges.
Yeah, first, that's it. The grave, the barren womb, and a dry field that you can't water it enough because the soil doesn't let you water it. So you pour water on this field and you think it's saturated, and the next day it's still dry. So where are you going to get more water? Well, it's going to cost you money to get it out of the city water supply. The other thing that's insatiable is a fire. If you ever seen a building on fire, it's going to eat up the building before the fire department gets there. The fire department's going to pour water on it, and probably too late. So a consuming fire. Our God is a consuming fire because he burns up all the old stuff. So these are interesting little reflective insights into life. The grave, the barren womb, the earth that is not satisfied with water, the fire that never says, it's enough. Now he lists some more. The eye that mocks its father, scorns obedience to his mother. The ravens of the valley will pick it out, and the young eagles will eat it. Boy, there's a curse there on an arrogant son who curses his parents. Does not take care of them, doesn't honor them, has used them, and has rejected them. And this sort of person ought to end up dead out in the desert with the ravens eating his eyes, eating his eyeballs out. And the carrion birds picking those eyes out. Because the guy's blind, he doesn't see. So he got what he had coming to him, his comeuppance. Now we get four other things here that are paths in life. There are three things which are too wonderful to me, four which I do not understand. So he's going to list four things that he marvels at as he looks at the world. The way of an eagle in the air, the way of a serpent on a rock, the way of a ship in the midst of the sea, and the way of a man with a virgin. Eagles are so interesting to see soaring up in the sky and coming down for dinner and taking the dinner up to the nest. And they're so lofty that you just have to admire the ability of an eagle to soar and to fly. The other thing that's rather interesting is to see a serpent on a rock, like a rattlesnake or maybe a gopher snake, slithering on a rock. And you can't tell what's rock and what's snake sometimes. If the snake is sunning itself, it's not moving. So he's walking out on a trip someplace, and he happens to look over at the rock, and lo, there's a snake on it. So it catches him by surprise. The way of a ship in the midst of the sea. If you've ever seen a sailing ship lurching and pitching and wallowing, and it doesn't sink, but and the captain is directing the rudder, the ship's going to get to its destination, but it may be a rough ride. So this is kind of harkens back to the old days of sailing ships and small ships. The other enigma in life is when you meet a man who has married a virgin. She's never had sex. She's never kissed another man. How excited she is. Does she really trust this man who's married her? What does he think when he can see that he can either honor and bless this woman, or he can destroy her. It's in his power, whichever he wants. So the way of a man with a virgin. This woman hasn't slept around for 20 years and then gotten married. She's not an old veteran of the affairs of men, and she's not going to manipulate her lover because they're both starting out. So, in contrast, we have verse 20. This is the way of an adulterous woman. She eats and wipes her mouth and say, I've done no wickedness. This is so common today in the sexual permissivity of our day, where you get women who have slept around or had several husbands and think nothing of it. It's normal. Well, it's not normal as far as God's concerned. So all of this is harkens back to the way God created the universe. He created it with integrity and harmony, and it's all messed up now. Now he lists some foolish things. Verse 21, for three things the earth is perturbed, for four it cannot bear up. And he lists them, for a servant when he reigns, a fool when he is filled with food, a hateful woman when she is married, a maidservant who succeeds her mistress. He's talking about conundrums and enigmas in life here, such as a lowly servant and a slave who rises up to take over and suddenly finds himself lording it over everybody and pushing him around and forgetting that he doesn't know anything but ways of a servant. The second example here is a fool when he is filled with food. A hungry person, a homeless person off of the streets when he gets his first square meal. And what does he do? He gorges, he overeats. He's not going to sample and have hors d'oeuvres. He's going to eat the whole meal. The third example here is a hateful woman when she is married. I've got a footnote there someplace that says...
Mine says an unloved woman.
Oh, an unloved woman when she's married. Oh, a woman who's starved for love, who's never been kissed, who's never had any man show to, and suddenly somebody comes along and takes an interest in her. Though that's... What a dynamic uproar. And then the other thing in this list, a maidservant when she succeeds her mistress. Here's a maid who has always been a servant in the household, and her mistress has retired or died or gone away, and the maid has inherited the whole house. She's going to suddenly do all sorts of things she doesn't know a thing about. She's going to be crazy. All right, so we get four small things in the next verse. There are four things which are little on the earth. Hey, these are trivialities.
One thing I wanted to say about a maidservant displacing, I'm thinking of Hagar also and Sarah, and how Abraham chose Hagar to bear the child. So sometimes the maidservant puts a prominent role in the family because she's able to bear the children. I think Jacob did that with a bunch of his maidservants, too.
That's right. That's very good. Those are good examples.
Yeah. So, and then how that displaced the main woman, Sarah. She was very hateful against, and that caused problems and rifts. And Abraham sent her off.
And the promised son came through Sarah in spite of Abraham sleeping with Hagar and having the son, Ishmael, who was made a great people on his own because God met Hagar and Ishmael when they were kicked out of camp and blessed them independently of Abraham and made them into the great peoples of the Middle East.
Right.
Four things which are on the earth, and they're little, but they're very wise. So you guys go learn from the ants. The ants are a people not strong. They prepare their food in the summer. There's an ant's nest a little ways away in this complex here. I like to go watch those ants because they're so busy and so industrious. They're hard workers. They're gathering food. They're moving sticks. They're cleaning out the nest. They don't have anybody shouting them orders or telling them what to do. It's all built into what it means to be an ant. Termites are like that. Ants in the tropics go on long marches. Termites go on long, long marches, and I don't know where they're going, and they're very busy because they're passing things two-way. They're passing food back, and they're building material. It's all, they've got some different classes, but ants are interesting. Oh, God made the ants. The rock badgers are feeble folk. They make their homes in the crags. Badgers and what are the animals that come out on...
Raccoons?
Huh?
Raccoons, is that what you're thinking of? No.
Raccoons? I'm thinking of the animals like that show up on Groundhog's Day that are like, they burrow underground, they come out on the...
Gophers?
The gophers, mm-hmm. Yeah. And they do quite well.
Prairie dogs.
They know how to raise their young, they know how to come out in the sun, they know how to go hide in the winter. And that's all built into them. They make their homes in the crag, so they're perfectly good at finding the right place among the rocks to nest and raise their kids. The locusts have no king, yet they all advance in ranks. Locust plagues used to devastate large parts of the Middle East. They still occur sometimes in Australia and Africa, and thousands of millions and billions of locusts will swarm. And the life cycle of the locust is very interesting because ordinarily they're solitary insects and they'd not be able to eat very much. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, they swarm and they get wings and they fly, and the whole sky is dark with swarming locusts. And they will go into a green, lush area and eat every green thing and the bark off of the trees and leave a lush ground. Piece of land and absolutely desert habitation. And you can't spray against them. There are too many to spray. There are millions of them. Sometimes locust plagues, they had them in California and in the Midwest in the 1800s. And caused millions and millions of dollars of crop damage. Mm-hmm. And you just got to wait until they die out.
Or you torch them and you put them on fire, but which ruins your crop, but it doesn't ruin the other farmers next door to you and things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you can so sometimes people, stop them with fire.
Yeah.
But if you generally you're fighting something that's many, many square miles of swarming locusts. So in times past, people have been quite helpless. Nowadays, you take helicopters out and spray them or burn them or whatever. Anyway, locusts. The spider skillfully grasps with its hands. It's found in king's palaces. Spiders are, this is interesting, they don't have hands. They've got six legs, I think. And they know how to use their legs. They're very specialized with their legs. And the spider is very crafty and very intelligent and very dangerous for its prey. And spiders come very, very small, and they also come as big as your fist. Tarantulas in the tropics. So... the writer here wants us to look at these things in nature that show a designer, show that there's an intelligence has equipped these creatures with tiny little brains, with a nervous system, with a reproductive system, with instincts, with hard wiring, so they get through life quite fine. Now we've got four stately things in verse 29. There are three things which are majestic in pace, four, which are stately in walk. So he wants now to look at another phenomenon in life. He wants to consider the lion, which is mighty among the beasts, and does not turn away from any wild, dangerous, huge creatures. You don't want to mess with the lion. Aslan's not a tame lion, but he's good. C.S. Lewis. So look at these lions, the king of the beasts. Look at the They're not afraid of anybody. If you've ever been to a big zoo like in San Francisco, the lions in there are enormous. They're huge. Yeah. And they roar. And they have to be fed raw meat every day. And you don't want it. The keeper gets in their cage with the lion, and the lion's in a bad mood. There's no more keeper. He's eaten up for lunch. No big deal. The second thing to look at here is a greyhound. A greyhound is a very fast racehorse, slim and slender, and The buses are named after the Greyhound. They have Greyhound races in the South. These special dogs are trained to race, and unfortunately, after their racing life is over, they're generally discarded or euthanized because they're of no use to anybody. A male goat is also noteworthy, and a king whose troops are with him. A male goat, I don't know if you've ever seen a he-goat. They can butt you and argue and fight and be very ornery and cantankerous, even if you're way bigger than they are. And you don't want to get on the wrong side of a goat because he'll just come charging at you with his horns and knock you down and think he's won. And you can't do very much about a goat. The other thing would be to consider is the king whose troops are with him. This is a rich king who's got an army who thinks he's infallible, unbeatable. So he just goes out and makes war and kills whoever he wants to, enhancing his power by capturing people and putting them in his service. So he's got force to back his claims. That's the idea. If you've been foolish in exalting yourself, or if you have devised evil, put your hand on your mouth. Shame on me. Oh, my goodness, shame on me. What a fool I've been. Oh, my goodness, I didn't realize all the havoc I was causing. Put your hand on your mouth. Shut up. Keep your mouth closed. Don't open your mouth and remove all doubt of whether or not you're a fool. So, for as the churning of milk produces butter, as the wringing of the nose produces blood, so the forcing of wrath produces strife. I don't know if you've ever seen a butter, but milk out of a cow being churned. We used to have churning mills when I was a boy. You take the cow milk and you put it in this centrifuge, and the cream floats to the top and goes out one spigot, and the ordinary whole milk comes out another spigot, and the lean milk comes out another spigot, and you make cheese and butter off of the fat. So that's the idea here is the way you make butter is to churn whole milk from a cow. That's all done in huge factories right now where the cows are milked and the milk is processed and put in big tanks and then it's bottled and comes to Safeway. In big tankers nowadays, not even in containers. If you have been, so he says, if you have been foolish in exalting yourself, if you devised evil, put your hand on your mouth. The churning of milk produces butter, as the wringing of the nose produces blood. If you really strain your nose blowing your nose too vigorously, those little blood vessels in the nose will open and you'll get a bloody nose. You just don't do that. The forcing of wrath produces strife. Don't provoke a fight that you can avoid. Don't start something you can't stop. So that's all these things, inevitabilities in life. Chapter 31, the words of King Lemuel, the utterance which his mother taught him. We don't know who King Lemuel was, but he's had a really good mom who's trained him. We don't know anything about his dad, but she says, "What, my son? What, son of my womb? What, son of my womb? What, son of my vows?" Good advice. Do not give your strength to women, nor your ways to that which destroys kings. Hey, don't let that woman take advantage of you. She'll steal everything that you've got. She'll take advantage of you and drag you down and ruin you. Don't get in a situation with the wrong woman. That's what the mom says here. Son, she's seen it happen.
And women is plural here. And
it
I'm thinking is. Of Solomon also had all those many wives.
Yeah.
And back in Deuteronomy, it told them not to have lots of, kings should not have lots of wives.
Yeah.
Or horses or, you know, this kind of thing. Because the wives can influence you in the wrong direction. Yeah. And that's what
happened. And so this is the kind of advice a mom is best at telling, because she's seen it all. It's not for kings, O Lemuel. It's not for kings to drink wine, nor for princes intoxicating drink, lest they drink and forget the law, pervert the justice of all the afflicted. A king can have a glass of wine with dinner, but if he gets drunk, he's going to make very lousy decisions because his mind has been dulled. His senses have been dumbed out. And he's not going to be a king that's fair and just.
Well, and he portrays a bad example to other people, too.
It's a bad example for other people.
In his council, so they might be drunkards, and they also might be.
Give strong drink to him who is perishing, wine to those who are bitter of heart. Let him drink and forget his poverty and remember his misery no more. If you're really miserable and down and out, then, hi, Steve. Come and join us.
Speaking of miserable and down and out, and I show up.
Hi. Well, here's a case in point.
Yeah. I've got to get back in touch with Lawrence, and I have stuff to bring upstairs. So excuse me again. Bye-bye.
Okay. Thank you very much. If you see somebody who's got a lot of pain from cancer or surgery, there's no harm in giving them an extra glass of wine or a glass of rum or something because it's going to mellow them out. And they're not doing anything else except living in pain and suffering and sorrow. They're terminally ill. Or you get a wounded soldier on the lying on the battlefield waiting to be rescued by the medics. Sometimes the best thing they can give is have a shot of brandy while they're there. It mellows them out. You don't get them drunk. Open your mouth for the speechless. In the cause of all who are appointed to die. Open your mouth, judge righteously. Plead the cause of the poor and the needy. Champion the cause of the underdog. Lift up the person who is poor and destitute, has no place to live. Don't make life worse for them. Take them in if you can. Speak up for them. Defend their rights.
Kind of parallel to what Jesus said about being servant leaders, right?
Servant leader.
Right? So we want to take care of those who are
take care of those
charge.
Who are needy. Yeah. And that's what Jesus did. Now we're going to get this famous section on a virtuous woman. And the author says, who can find a virtuous wife? A good woman is very hard to find. Her worth is far more above rubies. The heart of her husband safely trusts her. Notice the safely trusts her here. She's not going to betray him. She's not going to cheat on him or sleep around with other men or she's not a two-timer. She's utterly loyal and faithful to her husband and to the Lord, and she keeps herself busy being productive and fruitful no matter where her husband is or how well he's doing. He could be on a long journey and she still goes through the same routines. He will have no lack of gain. Honey, I darned your socks while you were gone on your trip. Or, honey, we're low on food, so I baked bread today. Or, dear, the kids needed new clothes, so I mended the clothes that your cousin sent us. In other words, this woman is practical in running the family with or without help from her husband. He's probably out plowing the field all day. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. She seeks wool and flax, willingly works with her hands. In the old days, you'd take yarn and spin it into cloth, and you'd take cloth to make dresses and pants and socks, and every item of apparel was... My grandmother had a spinning wheel, and a spool of yarn goes over here, and the thread comes over here, and it's a very arduous task where you take a lump of raw wool, raw cotton, and you spin it into threads, and then the threads go on a loom, and you make you weave cloth. Most everything we have is woven now. It's all done by machines now. But
now this also says this woman... is in his life all the days of her life. So this idea of divorce has never entered her mind. And that this marriage is forever.
She might be married a jerk. He may never show her the love that she ought to have.
But it's still forever.
It's still forever, yeah. So she made a commitment to this man for better or for worse.
Hard to find people like that nowadays.
Oh, boy, is it ever.
Divorce is always on your mind.
I want my rights.
Yeah.
She seeks wool and flax, willingly works with her hands. She's like a merchant ship. She brings her food from afar. Oh, I really cooked a special dinner for you tonight. I went down to the grocery store and I got you some pomegranates and I got you some avocados and I made you a super salad like you like. And so I know you're tired. You've been working in the field all day. Come on in, relax. Dinner's on the table. You see, that's this woman. She also rises while it is yet night. She gets up extra early to clean up the kitchen, to make sure the dishes are all clean and put away. She carries out the garbage. She vacuums. She scrubs the bathroom. She
gets breakfast ready. Yeah.
She gets breakfast ready. I know you're leaving early today. I made you your favorite scrambled eggs and ham and some toast and some jelly. And there's some hot coffee. Can you sit down now? I know you got to leave soon, but it's all on the table. See that? She got up at 5 because he had to leave at 7. That's the idea. She provides food for her household, a portion for her maidservants. They got 6 kids. Those kids have to be fed, bathed, clothed, and sent off to school. When the husband leaves, that's what she's got to do. She's got to take all these 6 kids. And then after that, she's got to go look at the maidservants. Very common in ancient households to have one or more servants who depended on the generosity of the house for their very sustenance. So you got to feed them. And some of these maidservants are going to work real hard all day, scrubbing the floor and waxing and cleaning the car and all that. So they've got to have a good meal. You can't just feed them scraps. She considers a field and buys it. From her profits, she plants a vineyard. She's been saving up. My grandmothers both had a pot in the kitchen, which was for nickels and dimes and pennies. And they'd save up until they had $10 or $20, and then they'd go buy something useful because the family income was small. And the husband wasn't going to come home and give her a bunch of cash, she's going to scrounge it. Maybe she'll make jams and jellies and sell them. Or she'll make handicrafts and sell them to get a little extra income for her household. So this is an enterprising person. She girds herself with strength and strengthens her arms. I remember my grandmothers and my mother, too, when we were little, the old-fashioned washing machines. A whole day of the week was called wash day. And you get out this big, cumbersome washing machine with an agitator and plugs in and with a wringer and 2 rinse tubs. And a lot of work to set that all up and fill it with water. And you have 6 or 8 batches of clothes, starting with the white clothes and the work clothes last. And you put the clothes in the wash, put them through the wringer, put them in the first rinse, the second rinse. Very hard physical work. Then you take these baskets full of heavy, wet clothes out in the backyard, and you hang them on the clothesline. I don't know if you've ever seen a clothesline before, but you see these sheets. In fact, it's sometimes called airing your laundry, because everybody in the neighborhood knows what kind of linens you have and how clean and neat you are. If you're rich or poor, it shows up on the clothesline. And then all day long the clothes dry out in the fresh air, and then later in the day, after a long hard day, you go gather the sheets and blankets, and then they've got to be they've got to be ironed and folded and put away. Well, that's hard work. It's not, the guy at the office is not working that hard. She stretches out her hands to the distaff, spindle. Her hand holds the spindle. She extends her hand to the poor. Yes, she reaches out her hands to the needy. I remember back about 1936, when I was 4 or 5 years old, we had a lot of hobos come into town. They come in on the railroad, and they had no money, and they'd go work, knock on doors until somebody hired them. My mother would often hire a hobo to work 4 hours chopping wood. And then he would get a sandwich and a glass of milk. That was all we could afford. And the guy was happy with a sandwich and a glass of milk. He'd go down and get on the next train and be a hobo and go out of town. Well, that's, we don't have that today, but that was what I remember. She makes a tapestry for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. In other words, rather than just having work clothes to wear, she knows how to dress up for a special occasion. She knows how to be a classy. Oh, look at that. Oh, my goodness. She's elegant. She's not somebody that her husband's ashamed of. Brings company over to the house, and she's not in her old grubby work clothes. She's all neat and clean, and after working hard all day, she's dressed up because her husband's going to cook dinner because her husband's bringing the boss home for dinner tonight. And is the boss going to be impressed? Darn right he is. But the day, the work day of this woman is more arduous than most men know anything about. They go to the office and sit in a chair all day. She makes tapestry for herself. In other words, she can even get around to decorating the house with curtains, with attractive things. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. So this man has a good reputation in town because of his wife and his family and the home that she keeps. Everybody in the neighborhood knows her, respects her, and that reflects back to the husband, and it reflects to the people that work with him. Or it reflects, if you're a farmer, it reflects on the neighboring farmers. Farmers have good reputations and bad, depending on how they run the farm. She makes linens and sells them. She supplies sashes for the merchants. Strength and honor are her clothing. She shall rejoice in time to come. God's going to bless her and honor her. Her productivity is just as important in the scheme of things as the man's productivity. This is where our culture is chauvinistic, because we think that man is the breadwinner and that a man works from sun to sun, a woman's work is never done. Women are supposed to live lives of drudgery and misery, and they're supposed to be second-rate citizens. Not this woman here. She's got a great reward waiting for her, because God's watching all this. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and on her tongue is the law of kindness. So she has the neighbor ladies over for coffee, and she encourages them and prays for them and builds them up, and she finds room to do that. She watches over the ways of her household, pays attention to the kids, who their friends are, what they're learning in school. Maybe she homeschools them. She watches over the ways of her household, does not eat the bread of idleness. She didn't sit around watching TV all day, and she doesn't read the fashion, the romance magazines and dream of becoming a star. She doesn't do that. Her children rise up and call her blessed. Hey, Mom, good to see you. How can I help you today? You're the greatest mom in the world. Hey, Mom, thanks for breakfast today. Hey, Mom, thanks for taking me to the zoo. Her husband also, and he praises her. He says, thank you for the promotion at work. The credit goes to my wife. It's really her encouragement, her unconditional love that has enabled me to be productive.
So, behind every great man is a great woman.
Behind every man. I've always said that when you see a man that God is using, don't go talk to him, go talk to his wife, because you'll find out the power behind the throne.
Eleanor Roosevelt is an example.
Eleanor Roosevelt. Oh, yeah. It was Eleanor Roosevelt. And FDR was a jerk because he was unfaithful to her most of their married life. And she was homely. She was not attractive. But she was one of the most gracious women who ever lived. She became a representative to the UN. She was, I remember when she'd talk, homely and plain scuffed and buck teeth. But boy, was she a woman of stature. And as a result, FDR was honored and blessed beyond what he should have been. He should have been exposed as kind of a charlatan.
Yeah.
Many daughters have done well, but you excel them all. Charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her of the fruit of her hands, let her works praise her in the gates. Women are therefore just as important in the scheme of things as a man is. We have different callings, but God is watching over every girl, every woman, every grandmother, every aunt, and will reward them richly. I think that's why in heaven we'll have men and women, won't have marriage, but we'll have men, women, boys, and girls, all of whom have known Jesus and love Jesus. And that's going to be the criterion, I think, of how we're going to live with each other. And God's going to make sure that nobody's overlooked. I don't know how this helps us bachelors, because you think, oh my gosh, how can I ever succeed in life without this kind of a good woman behind me? Well,
you can admire them.
Yeah.
And support them.
And you get an enormous amount of help out of a grandmother or an aunt or your sister. And the friends you have, single people can have close woman friends, no big deal at all, especially in our day. So now at this point, Silent Dave over there will have some words of wisdom for us. No. 47 minutes. Oh. How do I stop this thing? Oh.